Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're cracking open a story that, well, starts out sounding almost mundane, doesn't it? Quiet domestic life. But it spirals pretty quickly into something, well, deeply unsettling. One of the stranger urban legends from mid-century America. The tale of the Milkman of Manhattan.
Yeah, and this is a dive, really, not just into, you know, the fear of people disappearing, but into how trust itself works, or rather, how it can be manufactured. And then exploited, weaponized even.
Right.
We've got these source materials describing things that supposedly happened in 63, 64 New York City. And crucially, we have this framework from the Listeners Inspector Story podcast index notes, which is super helpful.
Those notes really give us our task, don't they? We're not just like retelling a spooky story. We're trying to analyze the system using these lenses, cult of charisma, systems of control, and a symbolic erasure. We need to figure out how something so again. Every day, like a milk delivery, a glass bottle on the porch, how that became, you know, the central piece in a machine built for isolating people and getting rid of them completely.
That's such a key point, because if you just look at the, I guess, the shocking parts, you miss the mechanics underneath, how it was built. We need to look at the symbols he supposedly used. Milk for trust, obviously. Then the boxing ring. For what? A trial. A test. And then heat, the incinerator for, well, erasure.
The index notes frame it right away as being about these psychological traps, like that Monopoly entry reference.
Yeah, the idea that any closed system, any game, it sort of trains you first, right? It gets you used to the rules before it takes anything from you. Or it pays out, for that matter.
Or the Aladdin note about how the treasure is often just bait for the trap.
Precisely. And here, the treasure was this, like, super personalized, friendly service. I'm your guy.
So the source material kicks off with this question, and it really sets the mood. Who was the most dangerous man alive? And the answer, maybe, chillingly, was the guy invited into, what, 72 different homes? Routinely.
It's the boldness of it, isn't it? Taking systems built on reliability, on domestic comfort, daily deliveries, they rely on routine, consistency, people don't think twice.
Right, low resistance.
Exactly. And his system apparently just plugged right into that, exploiting that sort of automatic obedience, that false front of familiarity. Oh, it's just the milkman.
Okay, let's really try and picture this. Manhattan, 1963. It's dense, right? Brownstones, stoops right on the street, tight-knit neighborhoods, but maybe still kind of anonymous in that big city way.
Definitely.
And into this scene, you have door-to-door salesmen. Which wasn't weird then. It mixed this sort of intimacy, someone at your door, with the fact that they could be a total stranger.
Right.
So you hear the sound, maybe glass bottles clinking, and this particular milkman is doing his rounds. Seems normal.
Well, and it's worth pausing here for a sec. Because door-to-door sales back then, they really weren't unusual at all.
That was pretty standard.
Totally standard.
Right.
Reports from 1960s NYC confirm it was common. Often pretty trusted, actually, sometimes regulated by area schedule, stuff like that. But it always, always relied heavily on making that personal connection to close the deal.
Okay, so he was operating within a system people already trusted?
Precisely. Which just makes how he apparently twisted it, well, all the more disturbing. He just weaponized that need for connection.
In his sales approach, according to the sources, it wasn't just random knocking, he was really targeted. Very specific.
How so?
Apparently, whenever he knocked, he wouldn't just ask if anyone was home. He'd always ask to speak specifically to the father of the house.
Ah.
So not the person usually doing the shopping, maybe. It was like a direct line to the male head of the household. A very focused recruitment.
That's interesting. Why the father, do you think, in that era, targeting the guy, the quote-unquote man of the house? Well, it isolates the perceived authority, right? Maybe the financial decision maker?
Yeah, maybe bypasses the usual skepticism. Like, if a housewife might be wary of a pushy salesman, maybe the husband wouldn't be, or the interaction feels different, like business to business.
Could be. It suggests right away this wasn't just about selling milk. It was a system, targeted recruitment, designed to kind of neutralize the home's natural defenses from the start.
It's just, it's unsettling, that level of immediate focus. How do you make a cold call feel personal enough, specific enough to break through that fast?
Well, that's the cult of charisma, right? That's what the index calls it. His methods were supposedly incredibly efficient at building rapport, like warp speed.
So the pitch wasn't even really about the milk itself.
Maybe not primarily, no. It was about selling himself, his credibility, establishing that connection like instantly. We're talking rapid, almost manufactured closeness. Reports say by the end of a single pitch, he wouldn't just have a new customer.
He'd be, What was it?
Best friends with the men he was selling it to. That's the phrase used.
Best friends. Wow. That's intense. That implies such a quick, deep connection. Almost like exploiting a vulnerability, creating this instant loyalty.
That's the charisma lens right there. He could apparently compress what should take weeks or months of neighborly chat into one conversation on the porch.
And if you tie that back to the symbol, the milk itself is almost mocking then.
I don't even mean.
Well, milk is like the ultimate symbol of home, trust, routine, safety, nourishment, the family unit.
Right. Basic goodness.
So by attaching himself to that product, he gets this instant pass, a false front of absolute reliability. He's selling friendship wrapped in trust. So later, when things turn weird, maybe it feels like a choice the victim made. Mm. A favor for a friend, not walking into a trap.
Yeah, that makes sense. The product legitimizes the person.
So the takeaway from 63 is he's the ultimate con man. Using dairy like a Trojan horse. He wasn't delivering milk. He was delivering access. Planting seeds of loyalty. He could cash in later. Methodical. Trust converted into access.
Okay, so then the whole tone shifts dramatically. Yeah. 1964.
Yeah, that friendly routine, the porch pitch.
Yeah.
It just vanishes. And instead, you get this waves of like genuine fear spreading, but apparently very localized. Those same tight Manhattan streets.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have to picture the neighbors talking, the realization dawning. Husbands, fathers.
Mm-hmm.
They're not just late from work. Imagine the breakfast table, that empty chair. The silence where routine used to be.
Yeah.
It's chilling.
And the scale, according to the stories, is what really locks this in as a legend. Reports claim over 72 men went missing. 72.
Wow.
And all within this really focused, tight cluster of streets, which suggests, you know, he didn't need a wide net. He had this incredibly efficient, localized system for, well, for extraction.
72 isn't an accident. That's a system humming. That jump from friendly milkman to this.
It had to be planned, right?
Yep.
The charisma was just the first step. The switch got flipped.
Well, this is where we have to be a bit critical, too, and think about that legend versus record idea. Is 72 the exact verified number, or is that the number that sort of crystallized in the local stories?
The number that made the best story.
Possibly. Legends often smooth out the messy edges. Inflated numbers, perfectly consistent witness accounts. They make the narrative cleaner, more powerful. It's like that Real Wendy index entry talks about.
Remind me, what's the core idea of Real Wendy?
It suggests that after a big event, like a disaster or something really unusual, the official records might get frozen or scattered. But people's lives and the stories they tell, they keep evolving.
Ah, okay.
So maybe the real police reports were fragmented across different precincts. Maybe numbers were unclear. But the legend consolidates it. 72 victims. One clear villain, the milkman. It makes the story stick, makes it more potent, easier to pass down. That makes a lot of sense. And the way he apparently got them out of the house, it was terrifyingly simple, built right on that fake friendship.
The pretext.
Yeah, the families, the wives and kids, they consistently remembered the men saying the same thing before they left and never came back. They were going out to get milk.
Even if they already had milk in the house.
Right. Even if the fridge was full. Which is weird in itself.
And crucially, this was happening when...
Very late at night. That detail keeps coming up.
Okay. See, that's central to the control system. It shows he established this powerful kind of non-standard reason for the victim to leave home voluntarily, late at night.
When it's quiet, fewer witnesses.
Exactly. Guaranteed isolation.
Yeah.
Away from daylight, away from neighbors. He was basically setting an appointment that ensured privacy for whatever came next.
So going out for milk late at night,
mm-hmm.
that becomes the code, the trigger phrase.
Yeah.
And it works because it's tied to this essential item. And it's facilitated by this supposedly trusted friend,
uh-huh.
an emergency top-up.
And this links straight into the witness motif. Because when investigators, presumably, started asking questions, putting pieces together, what did the wives report seeing?
Almost all of them, the story goes, remembered seeing their husbands talking to an odd-looking man on their front porch right around the time they disappeared, that day.
An odd-looking man, consistent description.
Yeah, and that consistency is what apparently zeroed everything in.
Mm.
All fingers pointed to the milkman. Even if he looked odd, the charisma, the established trust, it must have overridden that gut feeling for the victims.
So that image, the odd-looking guy on the porch, masquerading as the friendly milkman, becomes the last sighting, the last anchor point before the system fully took over. Whether that description was perfectly accurate or just, you know, reinforced by the telling and retelling.
It solidified him as the one predator running this whole operation.
Okay, so the investigation eventually leads somewhere, and the discovery, Well, it's the stuff of nightmares, really.
Imagine the police, like, breaking through the normal pavement of a Manhattan street and finding, what, stairs leading down, hidden entrance.
Something like that. Descending into this secret underground space, hidden right beneath those streets where everyone felt safe, an anti-home, a lair.
A space built for the final stages.
Exactly. Yeah. This is where we move from the charisma analysis to the cold mechanics of the control system. The lair is the closed zone he created. Its contents reveal its purpose.
And the sources are specific about two main things found inside. Two things that are incredibly symbolic and just clash violently through the whole milkman persona.
Schwerber.
A boxing ring.
Yeah.
And an incinerator.
Right. Okay, let's spend some real time on this. This symbol set tells us so much about the operational protocols. The boxing ring. What does that suggest?
Conflict. A fight.
Structured conflict, maybe. A defined space. Rules of a sort. A test. A trial. It feels very controlled. It connects back to that Monopoly idea the game has rules, a defined space.
So the victim, lured in by friendship,
is now subjected to some kind of final controlled protocol within this ring.
But why a boxing ring? Like, literally boxing. Were these guys fighting him? Or fighting each other? That seems unlikely for 72 random men.
I agree. The physical combat angle feels maybe too literal. Or maybe just one possibility. The psychological reading is maybe even more chilling. A ring with its ropes, its center stage. It's a theater. A theater of what? Dominance? Submission?
So maybe it wasn't a physical fight, but a final confrontation, where the friend, the milkman, drops the mask and asserts total control. The ring is just the stage for breaking them down completely, isolating them one last time.
That feels more aligned with a system of psychological control. It provides the necessary boundary, the focus, for that final assertion of power before the next step.
So ring equals trial, or maybe subjugation.
Yeah.
And right next to it, the mechanism for making it all disappear.
The incinerator, yeah. That completes the loop. A terrifyingly closed loop. This ties straight into the theme of deletion, of erasure that comes up in the sources. Specifically, the Klaus Richter entry.
What does the Richter notes say about erasure?
Richter's work, as referenced, apparently looks at systems so efficient they leave nothing. Or almost nothing. It focuses on the impact of total disposal.
Meaning
when evidence is completely destroyed, like through incineration, the lack of evidence becomes the evidence. The erasure itself is the message. It says the system is designed to beat forensics, to prevent closure, to make the disappearance absolute.
Wow. So he wasn't just ending lives. He was trying to delete their existence. From the record, from memory even.
Mm-hmm.
Silent, total disposal. The incinerator makes the system invisible, untraceable.
So now we can see the whole alleged sequence, right? It's meticulously planned. Starts with milk, the symbol of trust.
Then the porch pitch, that's recruitment.
Which sets up the late night errand, the pretext, and crucial isolation.
Then they're brought to the ring, the stage for the trial, the final submission.
And lastly, the incinerator, the tool for total erasure.
Milk, pitch, errand, ring, incinerator.
It's a horrifyingly complete system. It shows how strategically he, or whoever this was, isolated the victims after building that trust, using this universal symbol of care, of nurturing, milk, to justify a system for immediate total disposal, that methodical design. That's the real horror here, beyond the individual tragedy.
Okay, so the story builds to this climax. The police finally locate the lair, they go in and they confront him. The milkman.
Imagine that scene down there underground. The only light may be flickering from the incinerator. The heat pouring off it. That has to be intense.
Yeah, intense heat, maybe the smell. And there's the boxing ring just standing there, silent.
Yeah.
He's literally caught between the symbols of his process, the trial, and the erasure.
It's a space designed to intimidate his domain, his rules, until now.
And when they confront him, he supposedly says this line. This famous line, which is weird because it's famously from something else, something much later, but the legend includes it.
What's the line?
The first rule about Fight Club is that no one leaves the Fight Club.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, definitely an anachronism borrowed later, but you can see why it's stuck in the legend.
Right. And the sources add, he said it with an evil smirk spreading across his face, just leaning into the villain role.
That phrase, the smirk, it tells you the legend itself was being shaped, embellished over time. People needed that satisfying moment of pure, quotable evil. It solidifies the narrative.
So, okay, then the police ask the obvious question. Where are the missing men? 72 families wanting answers.
And his response.
He just points. quickly, apparently. Points right at the incinerator.
Just points. No explanation, no remorse.
And then declares. This is the rapid exchange part. He declares.
Undefeated, baby.
Chilling. Absolutely chilling.
And that's basically the end for him. The sources are brief, non-graphic. They just say he then charged the police officers.
Yeah.
And things didn't end well for the milkman that day. The system was stopped. But the damage was done.
Let's unpack those last words, though. I'm undefeated. What does that tell us about his mindset?
It suggests this profound delusion, right? A complete detachment from reality or morality. He wasn't seeing victims. He was seeing opponents in some kind of game he invented. His success wasn't measured in money or anything normal. It was measured by his score.
His win-loss record in this horrific system.
Exactly. It links straight to that real-life Mario Index entry idea.
Which is about?
People who frame their whole life as, like, a video game, always chasing the next level, the next boss fight. For him, recruiting these men, putting them through his trial, erasing them, that was winning. That was the game. It's this pathological need for control, for the perfect score, zero escapes, zero traces.
He built this secret world where he made all the rules, judged everyone, and was, in his mind, the ultimate winner. Until the outside world broke in.
And that brings us back to the system itself. Regardless of his fate, what's really significant is the control, the hidden rules, the secret protocols he operated by. It's very much like the themes in the Disney World controlled zone entry.
Ah, the idea that the most effective control is the kind you don't see, hidden in plain sight.
Precisely. The milkman used the most mundane, trusted, frontage imaginable milk delivery to lure people into this hidden, totally controlled underground zone, a place where only his rules applied. He leveraged the public system of trust to feed his private system of annihilation.
The ease with which he supposedly turned routine into a death trap. That's the terrifying takeaway. Hashtag tag outro.
So this whole dive into the milkman of Manhattan, it's really been about contrasts, hasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. We went from that seemingly innocent porch pitch back in 63 that engineered friendship through the weird late night errands, the code words, all the way down into that hidden lair, that system built for trial and ultimately for erasure.
And we saw just how quickly, how easily, apparently, these everyday systems of trust, of friendliness, how they can be twisted, especially when you have that cult of charisma combined with really meticulous cold planning.
Turned into machines for isolation, for control. It's a stark reminder, isn't it?
Yeah.
That sometimes those dangerous things are hidden behind the most familiar faces, the most routine activities.
Mm. He sold trust by the bottle, then made sure no one came back for a refund.
So what are we left with? What's the final image?
What remains is the ash-cold, great, silent evidence of a terrible system.